You are listening to Level Up Your Gaming Podcast, Episode 63, Setting Difficulty. Today we take a look at setting difficulty levels in your game. We discuss how to modify combat situations to handle your unbalanced characters. We also discuss how to use difficulty to set tension and influence gameplay. If you'd like to participate in the discussion or leave us feedback, you can contact us at levelupyourgamingpodcast@gmail.com or find us on Facebook at facebook.com/levelupyourgaming. If you like the content and want to hear more of the show, subscribe and ensure you don't miss an episode. New episodes come out almost every Wednesday. Also, please review, tell a friend about the podcast, or share with your gaming group. Now sit back and enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Level Up Your Gaming Podcast. My name is Aaron, and joining me in person, he'll make sure his phasers are set to stun when necessary, Jared.
Yes. Yes, I will. Like, I don't know. You know, it's funny. It's a topic we talked about a long time ago, and it's one that I've always enjoyed is the difficulty of playing the hero instead of playing the anti-hero. Like, I don't know. There's not much more to say on the topic than we already did, but, you know, it's so much more fulfilling, I have to say, to play a straight-up hero, because it's hard. It's difficult. It's hard to be Batman.
It is hard. It is rewarding, though.
It is. It's so rewarding.
We have found that it's very rewarding in that, I think, I was just listening to the Gaming and BS podcast.
Free advertising, boys. Eat it up.
Free advertising for you. They were just talking about how, like, other game systems influence their gameplay. And I just think, you know, how the change from going from kind of characters that had no, were ambivalent to pretty much every situation,
yeah,
to characters that were heroic, like, that made such a big difference in that. I think I always wanted to play the hero. I think it was always in a lot of the characters that I put out there. And I think it completely changed our gameplay as a whole.
It did. Like, I feel like it ups the ante any time that I'm playing. It makes, how do I handle the situation as a hero?
How do I make it so I'm not just going to pull out swords and kill this guy, or pull out my gun and shoot this guy in the
bar? Well, like, gathering information is so much more difficult.
Yes.
In our old way, we're just going to beat it at him.
Beat the guy up until the guy finally talks.
But, like, when you are, like, the good cop, like, I have to make an intimidation roll. And then I've got to make a fraternize roll. Because first I want to scare him, and then I'm going to be his friend, be like, oh, I was never going to beat you up. You know,
or you're going to come in with different techniques. If you're trying to actually role play out the situation, you're going to ask questions in leading ways, trying to suss out information without asking, like, did you kill that woman?
Yeah, like,
that's the question you want to ask.
You
want to
trap them in their own answers,
but you're trying to role play out how that would come about. Like, I could just roll dice see if that will work.
There's nothing wrong with rolling dice,
but it's always fun to kind of role play out the interrogation.
And it is, and it, like, I don't know, I'm always about playing the hero now. Like, I don't want to go back. That is actually so, you know, for our listeners, Aaron and I are looking at doing a different game system just to try one out, like a one shot, just to feel it out. And I'm a little hesitant because this system is centered around criminals and the going back to being ambivalent. And but I think I got away. I think I got some ideas.
I think that you could still do it. I mean, I think we could still do it and have fun. I mean, for a one shot, like, again, you can have.
Yeah, but, like, I think I figured it out because I still want the high level of gameplay that we've been experiencing in the last two, almost 3 years. You know?
I think we'd still get it.
Yeah. I think so too. So what's the topic for today? Because that was a total side tangent.
That was, yeah, totally, 4 minutes. Totally not related to the topic, but all just a very important conversation. We're going to be talking about setting difficulty.
Okay.
And what's really interesting about this is that I think it kind of segues off of, I was actually talking to a mutual friend of ours, Tom,
and we play board games on Wednesday nights.
Which Tom? Tom P or Tom P? They're both Tom P.
You select your favorite.
Ba-dum-boom.
So, yes. But we were talking, and he actually had listened to our episode on being stuck in a lane. Mm-hmm. And he had talked about, you know, our current D&D game and, like, you know, kind of how the D&D plays into that trope of being stuck in a lane. Mm-hmm. But I'm also, like, it also is the challenge of setting difficulty. Because the problem in D&D that I'm starting to realize is that the encounters are designed assuming that you have picked the most optimal choices to create your character, and also that you play tactically within the situation. So if you create an encounter that is to scale, but your players are not to scale, like, you know, they're just not, like, up to snuff for those types of enemies, like, even though they're the right level, because they're not the right combination of classes, they're not the right, you know, yada yada, the encounters go from being kind of difficult to being extremely difficult, almost deadly. And, like, that's kind of where I wanted to jump you off here.
You know, it so in a situation like that, that's D&D, there is this inherent system. I don't want to say flaw, because there are a lot of people who've figured this out, but is that if I have somebody who is a tank for the team, or very dexterous. Let's go with dexterous, because they can hop around, and I think we've talked about this. You know, they can you know, they got a DC of, like, isn't that, it's DC, right?
AC.
They got an AC of like 20. All right. Well, I need something that might have a chance of hitting him, and let's say, like, my average, anything above a, I don't know, a 10, I want to be able to hit him, right? So, you know, I'm going to make sure it has at least a plus 11 attack. Well, I've got three characters that have a AC of 13. And if that has a plus 11 attack, if I roll a 2, I'm hitting. Anything above a botch, essentially, a critical failure, I'm hitting.
Yes.
And how do you counterbalance that as a storyteller? You know, really, this is one situation where cheating... blatantly cheating will not help you, because it'll be noticeable. It'll be extremely noticeable. Oh, I hit under a 2 again. You know, like, come on, dude. How many times can you roll under a 2? Unless you're me, because I don't have the luck of the Irish. I'm married to a beautiful Irish woman, but I don't have her luck.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You can't cheat your way out of it. You can't cheat your way out of it.
Here's what you do.
I mean, the only thing that you can sort of do, but your players will catch on to this, is you could only have the monster attack the person with the high AC.
Nope. I mean, yes, you can do that, but exactly. Your players are going to catch on. now, granted, some would say, well, that's the tactical of the game. But, you know, you have your bard. I don't know if bards can taunt towards a different player, or can they only taunt towards themselves? Like, come here, you bastard.
I mean, I think anybody can technically taunt. I mean,
no, like, isn't there like an ability taunt?
Sure, probably.
Why not? But either way, like, you know, it's like, oh, we would have the bard, you know, taunt the dragon towards the, I don't know, the flippy, dewy rogue, while the archers, you know, continually attack the dragon from range. My thing is that at this point, as a player, the statistics of the game have completely dropped me out of the suspension of disbelief, because I'm hitting this dragon with a fucking arrow, right, doing damage. I am stabbing it, yet because the bard is going, that guy over there called your mother a salamander, the dragon's dumb enough to fall for this? Like, no, no, no. And my suspension of disbelief is gone. Really, when you've got these varying levels of AC, right? I have, off the cuff, I can tell you there's two solid ways to, two positively based ways to handle this situation. Because a negatively based way would be is to encumber the rogue. But again, it's going to be noticeable. Wow, this is the fourth time when we entered in a combat that my foot got stuck in some deep mud and I have a negative 7 AC. He's going to catch on real quick. And it's also a negatively charged thing. Where possible, focus on positivity rather than negativity. Always remember that. It's going to add to the experience. So one, as responsibility of the storyteller, find a way to close the gap by charging your archers and your bard. So, you know, do we find, you know, the I don't know, boots of Hermes? 3 pair. Well, you know, come up with a better way than that, or, you know, something that will increase the ability level or AC of your 3 people that are so far behind to come near the level, you know. And I'm not talking like all of them need to have 20 AC now. I'm talking put them in a 17, 16, 15, you know, something where at least at a dice roll, sometimes I will hit the rogue and sometimes I will hit the bard and the, you know, get them close, bridge that gap by empowering the characters. And there's many cool ways to do that, you know, introducing spells that have been cast on those 3 because, you know, whatever, or just there's such a variety of imaginative ways that you can tackle that. They find 3 matching pairs of the boots of Hermes. I don't think that's very imaginative, but you know what I mean. The second way to do it, which is more of my classical way, is customized villains. If I have people, so with D&D, again, it's much more noticeable. So I will, you know, even though I don't storytell or DM Dungeons and Dragons, in this situation, what I would do is, let's say ninjas drop from the ceiling of the inn, right? I'm going to make sure there's 2 red ninjas and the rest are black ninjas. Black ninjas represent that they've got like an AC modifier of, I don't know, 4. Or a DC modifier.
Yeah, a hit modifier.
A hit modifier of 4. So if I roll a 9, I can probably hit one of the other players, or 9 or above. I can hit one of the bards or the archers. If I have the red ninjas represent a modifier of 10. Okay. My red ninjas are only going to attack my rogue. That's all they're going to attack. They will not engage despite, you know what? I might have them attack and fudge a roll just to do a little bit. Like, for example, if one of my archers, like, I'm going to shoot. We killed all the black ninjas. So we're going to go after the red ninja now.
There's where you could fudge a roll where the red ninja then misses.
Precisely. And it's one attack. Don't continue to engage because you're pushing your luck. Let him throw a shuriken. Is that how you pronounce that? Shuriken? A ninja star.
Yeah.
There.
The other thing that you could do there is when they hit, you could have them hit. And so like, oh, geez, I can't.
Oh, my God.
Why am I engaging with it?
Shuriken to the shoulder.
Yes.
Ninja star to the shoulder, because I'm probably pronouncing it wrong.
But that's an interesting point there, of something that you could do. I think another thing that you could do is, I know you're using 10 as your baseline, but 10 means that you're going for a 50% on there. I mean,
oh, we're getting into the math. We promised we would not get into the math.
Well, I've got to give a little bit of math here. I mean, okay. like you, what you really want is you want it to happen like 30% of the time you hit, okay? Maybe 40, okay? But you want it to be less than half, because you then have the opportunity where you don't need this high of a hit modifier to hit your crazy guy when you, like, succeed, and then you give some wiggle room to the lower people.
And yes, now I will say this. We are getting into the math of it now. Aaron opened up Pandora's box. Okay, here's my thing. Your heroes are supposed to be heroes. We don't come to the table because we want. Well, there are
some people do. Some people just want to do the MASH monsters, get loot.
And if they do, what you're going to do is you're going to bring down that number to where I want to hit maybe 30% of the time. So you'd have like, you're going to set your you know, hit to six, or sorry, to only above 14, right? So I'm only going to hit maybe 30% of the time, okay? So in that situation, you can start calculating. That is the advantage of D&D, is you can make those calculations. When you look at other systems like White Wolf, there is no freaking way you're making those calculations. We look to Brian, who has got his PhD in mathematics.
Well, Brian's calculation is that it's a 30%, because one, you fail, there's a chance that you fail. There's a chance that you just don't succeed, and then there's a chance that you succeed. So 4 out of 10 times you succeed, 1 out of 10 times you fail.
Yeah, see, this is, to our listeners, this is the problem with hanging out with two friends that are substantially smarter than you. And when I say substantially smarter, I mean substantially. Aaron and Brian are both very good at math, and I suck. I can barely do basic subtraction.
But you fill in our gaps with history. You're much better with history.
That's true. Do you want to know about the Battle of Broken Timbers?
I'm good, thank you. But
see, that's the problem. Like, math blows your mind. History, people are like, no, I'm good, thanks.
Well, it's very interesting what I want to know about history. We're talking about D&D and saying difficulty here, not history.
That's very true. Okay.
No, but the interesting point with that is, and again, I'm sorry, I don't want to make this like super mathy here, but the thing that you need to make sure that happens is, I learned this the hard way in White Wolf in our last game, okay? Which is, I didn't realize how a dice pool of 4 dice on a 10-sided dice, 30% success, okay? That means that, you know, you roll them enough times, I'm going to hit you about 30% of the time, okay? I did not realize how...
Because in White Wolf, you have the active dodge. You have a 30% to hit. I have a 30% chance of fucking
you,
up.
You have a 70% to fuck up. So
you know, that's the problem with White Wolf, is that I have an active dodge where I could just fudge it. I can have 6 dice worth of dodge and get none.
Yes. So it's a little bit easier to fudge your rolls there. It's easier to hide it for your players. But also, it's just like something that has 3 dice. Like, I was kicking your guys' ass with something that has 3 dice, and you all have massive dice pools. You're like much higher than 3 dice.
Yeah, no, and that is something I learned a long time ago, and that's why I'll tell you most NPCs have 2 or 3. Like, if I want to take you guys through the mud, I want you guys broken and battered at the end of that combat, I'll give them 4. But like, most of the time, your average villain, your average bad guy has 2 dice.
And again, but in D&D, you have the luxury of knowing what your player's ACs are, okay? You know right off the bat what you need to hit that player, and you know that if I'm going to throw a troll at the players, okay, yeah, this is how much it needs to hit my tankiest player, and this is how much it needs to hit my least tanky player. Think about your dice pools there. And I get it, everybody, if you're playing D&D, somebody probably has access to a monster manual, knows all the stats, and if you know what the monster is, they're probably looking it up. And they're,
well, you look at them right in the face and you tell them, well, it's a Gandurken troll.
Yeah.
Look that up in your monster manual.
Just change the troll. That's the best option.
It's a blue troll. That isn't my monster manual. No, it's not.
And then when everybody is capable of handling the actual troll.
By the way, I found out something. If you do a villainous laugh because you're like a, you know, you're into gaming, and like I said, at work I let my freak flag fly. I'm like, I can't help out with that project on Saturday night. Why not, Jared? I have Dungeons and Dragons. Because that's how I describe it to everyone. They're like, God, you were such a nerd. I'm like, yes, I am. But when you do a villainous laugh at work, people are like, how could you do that? Because I was essentially, we're, we are billing our client like substantial amount for something that they need. So we're about to make a lot of money. And I went, and everyone was like, how can you do that? I'm like, years of being a nerd.
Again, the ways that this pays off in real life.
It does. Like, you know what? Like, I hope that me letting my freak flag fly encourages others to do the same. You know, don't be ashamed of loving Dungeons and Dragons, a hobby that has been around since the 1970s?
Late 60s, early 70s,
I think. I mean, like, guys, we're part of a hobby that derives itself from primordial storytelling and that welcomes others into a world of imagination.
Again, until like the last decade, I think it was more of a, I mean, yeah, this,
well, you had Satanic Panic.
Again, before the, like I said, before the last decade, it was more of a, you know, well, nerds play that, and then nerds kind of came into
chic
fashion.
We can thank Big Bang. Like, honestly, I'm not ashamed. I don't particularly watch the show. My mother-in-law loves it. I'm not particularly a fan, but it made geek chic, I think is the term. Geek chic. But back to our topic.
But yeah, so I mean, again, you want to make sure that whatever is going to hit is going to hit, and think about how often you want it to hit. Okay. Yeah. Like, again, because you got the 20-sided dice, the math isn't super duper challenging there, but you know, I want it to hit 25% of the time. I need to get over 15 plus the AC. Okay. Ta-da.
And there you go.
That's it. And make sure that you know how much you want to hit your tankiest player, and then see, okay, well, if that's the tankiest player, who's my least tanky player? How often does it hit them? If it hits them all the time.
That's why I said there's two solutions.
Yes.
You got to either bridge that gap, you know, make it close, or two, make sure he doesn't get hit by the red ninja.
But again, there's also times that you want to have that gap wide because you want players to now be trying to get in the way of the monster that keeps, get out of my way, I'm going after that guy over there. You want to put the tension in those fights.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. Like, yes, you got to study how you're...
KYP.
KYP. if you know your tank loves to be the hero and, you know, the bugbear is going to charge at your archers because they stabbed it, and you know that your tankiest player is the kind of person who's going to run in front of those archers, put his shield up and smash into the bear and hold it behind the shield while sweat drips from his brow and the archers try to reposition and run. Awesome. Awesome story. Know your players. Know how they're going to engage this. You know, if one of your players is like, well, this does suspend my disbelief because, dude, this is his spotlight moment. Your spotlight moment is hitting that bear from 400 yards. His spotlight moment is getting in front of the bear.
The other thing that you can do, again, this is more than just an AC and like hitting your opponents, is, like I said, one of the things with D&D is that the encounters are designed to be against the most optimal party setup. So if you do not have an optimal party setup, you are going to struggle in an encounter that is designed against a party of your level, like to be a challenging fight,
yeah,
against your party. So
I don't like canned.
What you do need to do, though, if you're going to be dealing with that, is look at, we say it for social, it sort of applies to combat. Make it two steps easier, make it two steps stupider. Okay.
Yep.
Always think about it in that way. There are times when you want to challenge your players, but not everything that you encounter can be challenging.
Okay? Absolutely.
And there are other ways that you can make things challenging. You can make things challenging by having waves and waves of enemies. Okay. Easy enemies, not mm-hmm. hard enemies to hit. They miss most of the time. They only hit, like, maybe they need to crit to hit you, basically. Okay?
Yeah.
But still, waves and waves of them will wear you down. You will take damage.
It's the, you know, it's interesting because I just read storytelling, an article about storytelling, and think it was in a role-playing book. I'm not sure. Or if it was online. But essentially what it talked about was just remember... No, it was... It was actually in the Blades in the Dark book. Talking about whether or not if a player gets kicked off a crew, will they ever find a crew? And it reminds the storyteller that the characters are specialists. They're really badasses. They're called to do these things because they're the bomb. And they'll always find a new crew. Just remember that your characters are the heroes of the story. You know, even if you're going for an authentic game, there's ways to remember that if you're going authentic, go authentic. Most people, this mainly applies to Dungeons and Dragons and the criminal element. Remember, most people are not highly trained. Your city guard are probably, they were drunkards with a penchant for violence. That was what really was a selection criteria for who would become permanent guards or work for the the local count or whatever, was your perchant and ability to commit violence. Because most people, 90% of this world has never been in a fist fight. You know, most people have never taken a swing, and most people will never take another human being's life. Most people. So there's a very select few that are like, oh, yeah, you want me to break a guy's fingers? Eh, I'm cool with that. These people are not exactly, they're not, because they have that perchant for violence and that kind of evil streak, they're not the most disciplined. It's very rare that someone is both extremely violent and extremely disciplined. That's usually, violence of action is a thing for military members. Look at our Navy SEALs. They are very capable of extreme violence when needed. It is for a good cause. They are soldiers defending our country. And they're very disciplined. You know what I mean? But it's such a small select few. It's very, very tiny. Most people in the armed forces drive trucks and operate computers because paperwork. It's a thing that's still needed. But going back to D&D, your city guard is, you know, and your criminals are thugs. They're not disciplined. Your character should mow through them because they are both disciplined and capable of violence of action in the hero's way. You know what I mean? Being the good guy, whatever. Unless you're playing villains games, and then it's like, all right, yeah, here we go. But...
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a good point. I mean, your players are supposed to be special.
The spotlight.
And the spotlight on the board. They are the spotlight of your game and your campaign.
But...
And there, again, it's just setting difficulty is all about choosing the tone that you want in the combat. Okay, is the combat there to sate my players? Okay, therefore the combat should be easy, or should be balanced against the villains.
And this is really where you want to set the difficulty, because what do you want the outcome of this one to be? Is it supposed to be a memorable one, like a big boss fight, and you want the Jedis to walk out of there with their robes torn, somebody's missing half a lightsaber, so he ended up fighting hand-to-hand, somebody's bleeding from the head, and they walked out of that battle with the Sith like, my God, we barely survived, but we got him. We got him. Or is it one where it's like, psh, once we got past his 40 guards, the Admiral completely surrendered the plans to the Death Star. You know? We didn't even have to pull out our lightsabers. That's the choice you gotta make. In the end, do you want it? And they're mid-range. You know, the world is gray. Hate to break it to everyone. Well, I'm a big fan of gray. It shows in my clothing. Big fan of gray. What you gotta look at is, in this combat, how do I want my players to walk out of there? Do they walk out like Antonio Banderas in Once Upon a Time in Mexico with the explosion behind him? His hair is still pretty perfect, and he's got a little dirt on him. Or do they walk out like Lone Survivor where, you know, he couldn't even walk on his own? You know, he needed the assistance of the Afghani tribesmen to help him. What is the end to the combat? And what will make your players, not always necessarily, remember, it's not always going to be sunshine and rainbows, and we always kick ass. Sometimes you can throw them the tough battle, and it might change the tone of your table, which is great, because like if they're used to, well, we walk through that one, then they walk out of one and they're like, holy crap, we barely survived that. They might get a little bit more cautious. If you've got a group that's throwing caution in the wind all the time, might be time to throw them one where they barely walk out.
There's also a good thing about having easier encounters is that one of the things that you want to try to instill is that you want your characters to play their character even in combat.
Yes.
Okay. So you might not always be optimally tacticians in the combat.
Which this is something that I've thoroughly enjoyed lately.
Okay. This is actually more fun in a way. I get that your players, probably in D&D and other games, your players are specialists.
Yes.
Okay. But at the same time, your players are not omniscient. They don't see everything that's going on in the map. And if you can get your players to start playing to what they would be perceiving in the fight on the map and not to be attacking the most wounded monster all the time, that is a better outcome and produces better combats in the long run. I would argue. Meaning, like, one of the things in our D&D game is once something goes below half health, it's bloodied, okay? So most of the time, we're just wailing on the same thing, not the thing that might make the most sense to engage with, okay? Which is, it's an interesting thought experiment there. And what you need to think about as well is that monsters that don't have pack tactics, okay, would probably do the same thing. They would engage with closest against, I'm going to circumvent this person to go attack this person over here.
I mean, that's a huge point. A huge point in combat, because, you know, you see the monsters acting a little bit too human. Typically, if you look at animals, because monsters would be animals, they have the same intelligence level. It's what's easiest to eat.
Some monsters are smart. Don't get me wrong. There are smart monsters that can do tactician-like things.
Like a harpy. Harpy can be tactical. But when we're talking about like a warg, a pack of wargs, you know, they're going to go over after what is easiest to eat. Oh, that looks, no offense, like, it sucks to be a gnome. Because like, it's like, psh, look at that little baby. I'm going to eat the crap out of that baby, you know, and that's where you really do need your team, you know, and the gnome's going to be like, why are they always attacking me? You're the smallest. If you actually look at, because I freaking love animal documentaries, it's the babies that get picked off by the cheetah, you know, the lions go after the smallest, easiest prey. They don't go after the big bulls. Are you crazy? Look at the size of that thing. I'm going to get hurt. Literally, animals tend to think like, is it going to hurt me? Nah, I won't go after that one. It's probably going to hurt me. It's weird, self-preservation in animals, but it's the truth. But there was one more difficulty that I did want to talk about. It's something that I have brought up, especially in White Wolf, quite often, especially in the mage game setting. So I've seen many storytellers make this mistake. I want you to imagine, for example, a player wants to turn a $10 bill into a $1 bill. So mages have this capability. It's you know, this would be simple material magic. So, you know, it's not very complicated.
Alchemy in White Wolf. Not White Wolf, at D&D.
So for most storytellers, if you want to take a $10 bill and throw it to a $1 bill, well, it's easy. Okay. It's because, and then, so then the player goes, okay, cool. That was a difficulty of, you know, let's say it was a, I don't know, DC of
10. It's difficulty
skill
of 6
check of 10.
Difficulty of 6 in White Wolf. It's a skill check of 10 in D&D.
Then you have a player who says, well, I want to take that $1 bill I just made and I want to turn it into $100. Many storytellers will fall into the pitfall of being like, well, that sir, is a difficulty of 10 and or an AC of 35. It's near impossible.
25 to make that $100 bill.
There you go. See, Aaron's done way more D&D than I have. And we do it because of how much it will affect the group, not the actual difficulty of the task. It's the perceived value of it. So, for example, another example would be, well, I'm going to bypass this door. You know, I'm a hacker. I'm going to bypass a door to the restroom. We make it a difficulty of 6. And let's say it's an electrician bypass or whatever.
Or I'm going to pick a lock in D&D, but it's just like an outhouse door lock.
Right. The guy who made the door lock to the outhouse was probably the same guy who made the door lock to the treasury. It's going to have the same amount of skill. Now, there are some exceptions. Yes. Like if I add extra layers of IT security because I know that one particular door is going to come under attack, or if I am the locksmith and he tells me, no, I want that lock, you know, super duper unpickable, and I'm going to get a thief to come in and try to pick it. He might spend more time on that one single lock.
This is the vault door versus this is just another door in the house.
Right, but you got to remember, most doors, you know, they're the same level of security. It doesn't matter if they, unless it is the true vault door. The best
That's why example, there was a master key in the old days.
Exactly.
They're respectively all the same type of lock.
Because... precisely, this is why most keys, like if you had the key to one room, you had the key to pretty much all the rooms, because to make different locks for different doors is mondo expensive back in the old days. Because remember, there's some guy wailing on a hammer making that lock, you know, like really detailed work. So instead he can make the same lock multiple times. It's our perception of value, not our adherence. Because, you know, we get all bent out like, oh, man, they're going to evade all the traps that I laid if they hack and open up all the doors instead of just one door at a time. And suddenly we increase the difficulty tenfold. And what we got to remember is that is our perception of value, not the actual situation. Because the difference between a $1 bill and a $100 bill is very little. Or for some people who might be like, well, a $1 bill doesn't have all the counterfeiting, yada yada. The difference between a $10 bill and a $100 bill is 10 and whose face is on it.
Yes. I mean, again, here's the crux with Jared's problem here with the dollar bill situation, especially in our mage game. If you wanted to just make a $1 bill look like a $100 bill to the human eye, okay, it is very low difficulty. Now, if you said that you want it to be non-detectable through counterfeiting purposes and you want to make sure the watermarks are all good and blah, 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 that's going to be more difficult because you're putting more effort into changing the properties of what's inside the bill.
Correct.
That's different than I want to make it pretty much passable to anybody who would pick up this bill, because most people would use like the marker or something to check.
I want to make sure that the marker will work and it looks right comparatively to, I want to make sure that the watermark is 100% perfect. And the difficulty should be the same for the $10 bill as it is for the $100 bill. If you're going to make sure that all the counterfeiting techniques are there and blah, blah, blah. And yada, yada. But we just got to remember this. And I've seen so many storytellers fall into that trap because of the perceived value. We also, you know, for example, we sometimes get into the weeds with difficulty due to our own knowledge. And at times I've seen storytellers botch a whole scene because let's take, for example, one of my favorite. Now, mind you, to our listeners, you will never see me on a sailboat, ever. As a child, something traumatic happened, and I will never be on a sailboat. Motorboats? Fine. Big ships? Fine. Sailboats? Never. Let's take our player who's really into sailing, and he's storytelling. He's like, well, turning the jib, that's insanely difficult. You know, you need years of training and hard work to learn how to slight the jib to make that hard turn without flipping the submast. What are you looking for in the story? We get our technical mind involved instead of saying, what's cool for the player? What's cool for the story?
Yeah, that's a really good point, is to not overthink technicality and let the difficulty take over those little technical details.
Yeah.
And instead, you know, always, to the thing that you're saying here, one of the things that you need to make sure that you always do is that no matter what the scene difficulty is for talking to a person and sussing out information, picking a lock, searching a room, doing XYZ, if it's important to the story, make sure that somebody's going to be able to succeed.
Exactly, because then you're like, aha, uh-oh. They never got the Emerald Key because I made it so difficult to find that none of my players found it.
Because I thought it was so important. Okay, if you want the meaning behind the Emerald Key to be very, very difficult to find, that's a different thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, but have them find it. Like, you might as well just give them the Emerald Key and then have them search for the meaning behind the Emerald Key if they want to keep searching the room.
And that's the thing. When setting difficulty, story trumps technical. Story trumps technical.
It's always a problem. I do it all the time. I'm sure Jared's done it a bunch.
I've done it. I still do it.
You go, okay, I want them to do this, and so I'm going to make them roll dice to do the thing. Okay. It's a technique for building tension more so than it is.
Yes.
It's a technique for building tension more so than it is to say whether they succeeded or failed. Okay. Because you want them to feel like, oh, if I don't roll this dice correctly, I'll fail. And then they roll it and you go, oh no, I got a two. And then somebody else rolls and they get a six and you go, all right, you found it. Like, you're playing with two people. Like, the person who got the two is like, oh my god, if you get like a one or something, we're screwed.
And it builds the tension.
Yes.
It builds that, oh my gosh, it's gonna happen. It's
or let everybody roll and then determine who wins the roll off effectively. Because if people roll low, they freak out. They go, oh my god, we're not gonna do this, we're not gonna find the thing we need to find.
And here's a tip with that, with the rolling, have everyone roll one at a time. Don't have everyone roll at the same time, because then you just get a shout out of numbers. You get like 18, 24, 36, 02. But when you have that first player roll and they get an 18, everyone celebrates.
It's better to actually call on the player like when they're in their action to go,
yes,
roll your die.
Yep. It's way better. It builds tension so much better.
Because that's what you want the dice rolls for, is to build the tension in the search. It has nothing to do with you actually impeding the search. In a lot of cases, because you want them to find the answer. I don't. That's
no. It is. You want them to win the combat. You want them to get them to talk their way into the royal treasury, because that's the story. The story isn't very good. Now, granted, you might have them fail a couple of times. You want them to try one way and another way and another way, because that's a better story. We tried three times. Look at any basic storytelling. You try three times and then finally you win. Goldilocks, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, she lost in the end. mauled by the three bears. But when you keep in mind that difficulty is a tension builder, it is a challenge builder, but story will always trump, then you've really gotten difficulty. You really understand it. Story is trump.
Yeah, anything else you want to add to this one here, Jared?
No, I'm pretty satisfied.
All right, well, that was just a little bit of us musing on setting difficulty in games. If you have techniques that you use for setting difficulty, if any of this resonated, you're like, oh man, yeah, I cannot put my players up against the best encounter that I've got. Or maybe you have ways that, oh, yeah, one more thing.
I do have one more thing. Sorry. just before you go into our sharing, I want to share something out loud. Everyone knows that I'm really into map building. You know, Aaron and I are not supported. This is, you know, just me sharing tools with everyone. I have found an amazing tool. It's only $20. It's called Dungeon Draft. I highly recommend it. It is such an easy, intuitive tool to building maps with a lot of coolness to it. It's very comic booky, which is my sort of way. So if you're looking for more of like digital virtual art, maybe not the best, but Dungeon Draft is an amazing tool. I found it about 2 weeks ago. Check it out.
I'll put it in the description.
Aaron will put it in the description. It's really very cool tool.
All right.
That's it. Sorry, I promise.
Perfect. Anyways, like I said, you know, if you've got other ways that you like to set your difficulty, maybe you've got your own formula, your own way of doing it. We're happy to share that with the other listeners, and we'd love to hear from you. You can contact us at levelupyourgamingpodcast@gmail.com or hit us up at facebook.com/levelupyourgaming. Go ahead and throw a little like there if this is your first time listening to the podcast, or join up to listen to that. Also, we are on YouTube. All of our episodes are on YouTube as well, so
smash that like button. Smash it so hard.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, break the computer. You smashed it so hard.
Everywhere you see us, just smash the like button. Okay. Smash like that's it. Yeah. Just smash
or it. Gently touch it.
Whichever you prefer.
Whichever you prefer.
And then also share the podcast with your friends, your gaming group. We do really enjoy all the listeners that write in and are listening to the podcast. And so this is for you. But this is going to wrap us up for the week. For Jared, I'm Aaron. Have a great week, guys.
Have a great week, everyone.